Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains and beyond. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful regions on the planet. It's great to be back for another episode of The Fern Line. Today I'm releasing part two in my series with North American alpinist Jack Tackle. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I would suggest checking that out, as the two episodes complement each other pretty well. Before we dive in today, I want to thank all my friends who came out to the first ever Fern Line Live last weekend at the Alaska Rock Gym. I got to sit down in front of a live audience and interview Alaskan legend Roman Dial. It was a super entertaining and fun evening, and the recording turned out great, so I'm really looking forward to sharing that with you guys here in the near future. I also want to thank everyone who continues to support The Fern Line on Patreon. I'm actually getting really close to my first goal, and when I do, I'm going to produce and release an episode that chronicles one of my own adventures in the mountains, and I'm actually really looking forward to that. If you want to pitch in on Patreon, you can do that at patreon.com/thefernline. Or you can go to thefernline.com and click Support the Fern Line. Other ways you can help out are by leaving a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, or by telling someone directly. Word of mouth is the best way to get information out there, and it helps promote the grassroots vibe I'm going for, so make sure you tell a friend. If you want to get in touch, you can email me at thefernline@gmail.com. I love hearing from all of you, and I love getting your insights and feedback about the shows. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair or work desk and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. Many years ago, I saw Jack Tackle give a slideshow in Anchorage. I was in my early to mid-20s at the time, and mountain climbing was the only thing that mattered. That evening, I listened intently as Jack described ice faces, corniced ridges, and run-out pitches that had long captured my imagination. But I was also impressed by the life wisdom Jack imparted. His laid-back style, coupled with a philosophy about the importance of vision, commitment, and trust, resonated in a way that made sense to me. I remember walking away that night feeling inspired and ready to apply some of Jack's hard-earned wisdom into my own climbs. But it's funny how life works sometimes. Shortly after that slideshow, I sustained an injury climbing that effectively ended my career and irrevocably changed my life forever. Although I went on to make a new path in art and music, I can say without a doubt that my life was never the same without climbing. Jack, too, experienced life-altering injuries that could have ended his climbing career. In 2000, while guiding in South America, he contracted Guillain-Barré, a rare and sometimes fatal disorder in which your body's immune system attacks the nerves. Although Jack eventually regained his strength, the disease created lasting effects, some of which still linger today. There was also the accident on Mount Augusta in the Wrangell St. Elias, where Jack was struck by a falling rock. The impact broke his neck, leaving him paralyzed on the face and stranded 50 miles from the nearest road. The ensuing high-stakes rescue would become the stuff of legends in the mountaineering world, but for Jack, it was an opportunity to move forward in life with a new perspective. 15 years later, and despite some limitations from his injuries, Jack is still climbing at a high level around the world. Over the years, I've watched his career from afar and often wondered how his brush with Guillain-Barré and the accident on Augusta affected him. That's why I felt fortunate to sit down and have a face-to-face conversation with Jack this last fall. We talked at length about his climbing career in Alaska, the Himalaya, and elsewhere, but we also talked about his life outside the mountains and how he's managed to navigate through challenging injuries and situations. It turns out, if it weren't for his friends, family, and partnerships in climbing, he wouldn't be where he is today.
So there's this longtime friend I've guided for a long time whose name is Tim Forbes. And that's who was with me when I got sick on Aconcagua, because I was guiding him on the backside of Aconcagua when I came down with this thing. And Guillain-Barré is, it's an autoimmune disease of the peripheral nervous system, right? I'd never even heard of it, you know. I know a lot about it now, but I'd never heard of it. So it's hard to do a Cliff Notes version of it here, but basically I got sick to a point where I couldn't walk very well and I was in a lot of pain and I had no idea what was wrong. So Tim arranged for a helicopter to come into Aconcagua and get me out of there, but they wouldn't take him. And ended up in the ICU in Mendoza for a number of days after that with no diagnosis, and he saw I was, you know, going down, because you die of Guillain-Barré through asphyxiation when the paralysis ascends to the point where, you know, it comes into your upper torso, and, you know, if your diaphragm's paralyzed, you know, you die because you can't breathe. Anyway, he arranged for a Life Flight Learjet to get me out of Mendoza and back to the States, and I ended up, we laugh about it now, but he asked me where I wanted to go, and he said, you know, you want to go to the Mayo, you want to go to La Jolla, to Scripps, you want to go to John Hopkins, and I said, I just want to go where my car's parked, which is in Jackson. So it worked out, but I spent 2 months in the hospital, 3 months in the ICU, 5 weeks, I think, in primary care. I was mostly paralyzed at one point, and I had to learn to actually do everything over, like sit up for starters. So coming back from that was, you know, an unexpected event and challenging. But like I say, all these people, you know, were super supportive and helpful and made a huge difference, you know. And so I had to work hard myself at it, but I got, you know, all this professional medical care, and then all my friends and my wife and my climbing partners were huge help. So, but if it hadn't actually been for climbing, in a way, I don't think I could have focused as well on trying to get better. Because one of these fellows that I had, clients that I guided for some time, he and I had planned to do the Grand Traverse in the Tetons that following summer. I got sick in January, got out of the hospital in late March or mid-March or something. Spent, you know, 4 months learning how to walk and or whatever else again. And then, you know, he comes and visits me and he goes, you know, I understand about next summer. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, I'll just get Chabot to take me on the traverse. And I go, fuck that, you know. So it gave me something to shoot for, you know. And so I ended, in August, I guided him on the Grand Traverse. It was harder for me than it was for him. But, you know, it gave me, you know, a goal to work towards. And so if it hadn't been for climbing, I don't know, you know. It might have been something else, but in my own experience, that made a huge difference, you know. Yeah. But what's the end result has been that I have permanent nerve damage in my feet, just in the front half of both feet. So I don't have really any proprioception. I have reduced balance and stability. I can't feel when my feet are cold, really. And I have a tremendous amount of pain when I crack climb. It just kills me, even though they're numb. So it's this weird combination of shit that is a neurological damage. It's, you know, it's not going to get any better. It's been, you know, almost 17 years now. But I learned to compensate. So it took me a couple years, but, you know, the whole thing that you interviewed Charlie about in part on our trip on Augusta, that was, you know, me trying to get back on the horse, which obviously didn't end very well. So it was sort of a rough year and a half there. Chabot and I went to the Ogre in 2000, and, you know, we tried to do the second ascent of the Ogre, and that didn't happen. And I got quite sick in Skardu on the way out, got viral spinal meningitis, which is, I think, what weakened my immune system to then 5 months later have this, you know, Guillain-Barré thing show up. And then, you know, I sort of recover from the Guillain, and Charlie and I go to Alaska in June of 2002, and then I get clocked by this rock, you know. So it was not a great stretch there for a year and a half. And fortunately, thanks to Charlie and Dave Schumann and the PJs and Daryl Miller and 100 other people, I'm still here. So I just kept plugging away, and, you know, I don't have the physical skill sets that I used to have before I got sick, but, you know, this trip you asked about with Jay Smith in 2009, you know, we did 5 climbs, 4 of them were new, and one of them was, you know, a pretty significant face that actually, they haven't had a second ascent either, for I don't know why, but, you know, I felt okay about it. So did Jay. So, you know, it ain't over till it's over, you know.
Jack's 40-year climbing career has been defined by significant climbs in Alaska's ranges and beyond. But the foundation for those climbs were always held together by a string of long-lasting and durable partnerships. I asked Jack to talk about his best partners over the years and what those relationships mean to him today.
Well, I've talked about some of these guys already, but, you know, I've been really fortunate, I think, I know I have, to have a lot of great partners. I think part of it has contributed to the longevity of me actually thinking that I can still do this for, you know, a period of time. But the first one, as I mentioned about Waddington and the first attempt on ice, was Ken Kearns. And, you know, he's still here. And I just talked to him, you know, a couple months ago. And we stay in touch. He's got three sons that rock climb, but it was a major turning point for him when he got hurt on ISIS in 79, but it didn't preclude us not staying in touch and not staying friends. So Kenny's one. Stutzman and I would have, I think, done a lot of things together, but right after Dave and I did ISIS, he got killed in an avalanche in Montana in Big Sky. 6 months later. After that, is when I started climbing a lot more with Danini. And Jim's still one of my best friends and longest climbing partners. And we've shared a lot other than the mountains through almost 40 years now. So those kinds of long-term partnerships and friendships, are pretty unique, I think. Or at least I view it as being quite lucky to have that. Alex Lowe was another person that I never climbed with in Alaska, but, was a Montana boy and lived in Bozeman, and we did a lot of winter climbing in the Tetons together, which was that thought about if you climb the north face of the Grand in the winter, you can get up something in Alaska, And, he was a much better climber than I was, but we had that common Montana thing and a lot of other things that we shared, and we did a lot of fun climbing, but no major expeditions, because he was working for North Face and I was working for Patagonia, and there was that. And he was on a different wavelength than anybody else, actually, besides, okay, not to mention myself. So Alex was an important person, still is in my thought. Jack Roberts, he and I did some good things, but, he's not here anymore. Chabot, and I are still really good friends. And, we went to the Ogre together in 2000, 6 years after we did the Elevator Shaft and 3 years after we did the Sound of Freedom. And he lives 6 blocks from me in Bozeman still. Charlie Cicera and I sort of are inextricably joined at the hip because of Mount Augusta. But, I just talked to Charlie a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm probably forgetting some people, but those are the main people, especially as it relates to Alaska. Oh, well, there's Jay Smith. So Jay and I, had this really great trip in 2009 where we did, a bunch of routes on Huntington and did this new route on the North Face of Thunder. So, Jay lives 2 blocks from here with Kitty, And those are the people,
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've lost a lot of friends over the years, probably in and out of the mountains. I guess I'm just kind of curious to get your take on how you process that or how you've processed it.
I think the longer it goes on and the larger the list gets, it gets a little harder, I have to admit. And yet, it doesn't make me want to quit climbing. Because the reality is, like what just happened to Hayden, Kennedy, and Inga really didn't have anything to do with climbing. Stutzman died in an avalanche. One of the guys I was on Everest with, Kim Mom, died ski guiding in the Monashees in an avalanche. You know, Alex didn't die climbing. He died walking on a glacier. So, you know, the amount of people I've known that have actually died technically, you know, climbing on some big mountain may not be as large as the list of people who have died skiing. But, you know, it's just tough, you know, especially younger people. Now that I'm not young, you know, people like Kyle Dempster and Justin Griffith lived across the street from me in Bozeman. And, you know, it's just, you know, this deal with Hayden's tough, especially because it's just a, it seems like, you know, there's clearly there's more people climbing. So statistically, that's maybe part of it. You know, younger alpine climbers are pushing, you know, and climbing at such high standards, but they're fast and they're strong and they're smarter than we were, I think, because there's just all this additional body of information and technology and all these things that can help you. But it's still the crucible of, you know, a place where shit can happen for sure, you know, in the big mountains that you don't have any control over. It doesn't matter how smart and how good you are. But I guess I've been reflecting on it because of recent events and the amount of people that, you know, like Schmitz died in a car accident, you know. McKinney died in a car accident, you know. So it ain't climbing alone that creates this loss. It's a lot of other things, you know. Closer to the climbing thing than anything else. But it's more the body of just the total amount of people that, you know, aren't here anymore that weighs on me more than a decision about going climbing or not. It's like anything else. It's a very individual decision. Everyone has to process these things their own way and either rationalize or justify or accept, you know, things in their own personal manner. But it's just, you know, but I guess the real question is, you know, would I choose to have not started climbing and not had, you know, whether it's the exposure to these people, much less the ability to have climbed and spent all this time and shared all these things with them? No, I wouldn't change that.
One of the recurring themes in my conversation with Jack revolved around living with injuries, a topic both of us know all too well. I can only speak for myself, but living with a chronic injury and not being able to climb is the hardest thing I've ever had to face in my own life. I asked Jack to talk about his own experience dealing with injuries and some of the tools he's used to navigate through that process.
Well, you know, I think, again, it's every person's situation is different, so you can't generalize about other people. I think everyone has challenges, you know. I mean, just aging is, you know. But, you know, there's always things that happen in life that don't necessarily have to do with, say, being injured that can also change. So in the case of Ken, I think I can speak for him. It was just a conscious decision that he was okay with, that, you know, his femur was an inch and a half shorter than it used to be. And he just decided to take a different path. And he got married and had three great boys and went back and got his doctorate in fisheries. And just, you know, not everybody needed to go to the Alaska Range every season, you know. So it's fine, you know, and I think everyone processes that. But, you know, often I, you know, I can easily feel sorry for myself at any given point in time for almost no reason. And then I'm reminded of people like Jeff Lowe. So I got nothing to complain about. And Jeff's amazing. He's amazing. You know, the time you spend around him is just inspirational beyond belief. So, you know, I'm a little, you know, impaired from, you know, this disease I had. It's not that big a deal. It's just not. You know, it's hard because I'm not as, you know, there's certain physical skill sets I don't have anymore. But it's probably, you know, a whole lot less than what you're dealing with, you know. But it's just different, you know, because I can remember what it felt like to be able to feel my feet, you know, and so forth, you know. It's not, you know, I got nothing to complain about. It's just a tool, I think, that you end up having to get dealt in life to, you know, learn and evolve as a person as a result. You can do other things, you know. It may not be what you want, but you got a choice, you know. You can try to learn and evolve and do other things, or just do things at a slightly different level or whatever, or you cannot, you know. So I haven't really written too much about the Guillain-Barré thing because I really don't feel like I have all that much to feel sorry for myself about. I mean, there was a life-changing event, and it was, it's an interesting story.
Yeah.
I'll admit to that.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, the way I got through it was my wife, Pat, and, you know, 100 of my friends, literally, you know, that helped me out. And it was primarily because of climbing that I had that network of friends and support and empathy and, you know, so forth. So if I hadn't been climbing, I'm sure I would have had some other network, but all I know is what happened, you know. And so for me, you know, I don't know anyone luckier than I am. I just, you know, I'm really fortunate. You know, we're sitting here looking at Castleton Tower, and there's not a cloud in the sky, and, you know, I can still go climbing, and I still have things I want to do, you know, but I ain't running the 40 as fast as I was when I was 18, you know. It's just the way it goes. You know, would I, if I could turn things back and not have gotten Guillain-Barré, would I do that? Yeah, I'd probably prefer that. But a lot of amazing things, you know, good things came out of that, you know. Mostly to do with other people and also resetting, you know, what was important. And, you know, personal relationships, like, you know, for some reason Pat didn't bail when I was being a real asshole because I was so sick and, you know, angry and all that. So I think there's a lot of positive that can come out of that stuff. But it's like anybody, you know, if you get in a car wreck and you're a paraplegic, would you? You can't talk for other people because, you know, I've talked to Jeff about this, and you know, and he's like the most enlightened human being I've ever known when it comes to this topic. You know, he's accepted his fate, if you will, but his place. And he's contributing in ways that he never contributed as a climber in a way that I would say is way more significant than, you know, and nobody did more significant climbing than Jeff. But here he is, you know, really being an inspirational person, human being, you know, that affects other people's lives in a very positive way, way beyond, you know, reading his name in the guidebook.
Yeah.
You know, it's, life is, you know, not all that straightforward sometimes, and it's what makes human beings interesting and complex.
Do you think, do you think you're ever going to not have a desire to climb? I mean, do you think that there will ever be a time where, just in general, you're like, I don't need to do that anymore?
You know, I've had people I know that just quit climbing. One of them just wrote a book about Jack, Simon McCartney, called The Bond, which is a really interesting and great read.
And, yeah, I read it.
And well written. But it's an extreme example of someone who just felt like, you know, I've gotten to know Simon, and he just felt like if he kept pushing it, he was going to die. And so he quit. And I've never, you know, personally felt like I had gotten to that, the edge of things that close to feel that way. I can understand a little bit more now than when I was younger about if that could happen. But your question was about how I feel. And I think climbing is actually a really great thing in that it's something you can always do at some level if you want, you know? It's not like, you know, being on the Olympic swimming team or gymnastics team when it's over, you know, before you graduate from high school, you know? You know, the answer is no. I'm not going to be doing some routes like I was maybe in the 90s, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Jay and I did these routes in Alaska, and it was long after I got sick, and, you know, Jay's shoulders were worn out, but, you know, somehow we pieced it together, and Jay's, you know, super strong guy and super climber and super guy. So part of it is, you know, would I choose to not share those experiences, regardless of what the climbing was like? I probably would be reticent to quit climbing more for that reason than the actual technical climbing, even though, you know, I've always enjoyed the movement and the, you know, the nature of the place that you are and the environment and the spectacular settings and natural beauty and all that, but, you know, it's... I mean, why would I want to do that?
The sun will rise again over the trees in Lexington. Place to leave my troubled world behind. Singing with my friends, I made all my amends. But the hardest ones to make were with my own life. Well, the Colorado took the tears I cried. In the Mississippi, helped me ease my mind. And no time for regret and races run. I said I can't wait to be in Lexington.
One of the most important relationships for Jack in the last 10 years has been his partnership with Jay Smith. In 2009, the duo quietly headed into the Alaska Range and put up a string of impressive lines on Mount Huntington and Thunder Mountain. I asked Jack to talk about this experience and what his friendship with Jay has meant to him over the years.
This song is for the ones I love the most. To the ones who follow dreams instead of ghosts. You got a hill to pay tonight. I'm gonna catch that train alright. I'm gonna take it to the river in the morning light. Then the water's gonna carry me to you.
You know, I've known Jay. He got me connected to Castle Valley here. You know, he was like the Chamber of Commerce for a while, getting people to move here. So, you know, where we're sitting here, looking at Castleton Tower, the first climb I ever did here was with Jay on the north face of Castleton. I think it was in the mid-90s. And we had met, actually, not that long before that in Patagonia. I was down there trying to guide this client, a friend of mine, up Fitzroy. And, we, you know, turns out Fitzroy hadn't been guided at that point, and I found out why. But anyway... Jay was camped right next to us. So we got to know each other there. And we had a lot in common, you know. And I'd met Jay actually in Alaska, actually, right after Stutzman and I did ISIS. I'd run into him in Talkeetna. But we didn't really know each other. So anyway, his, you know, his body of work in climbing is staggering. You know, it's like right up there with Jeff in terms of creativity and new routes and important routes and hard routes. So we had, you know, a lot in common. But once we started hanging out here in Castle Valley together in the spring and the fall, we started talking about maybe, you know, doing a trip to Alaska. And we actually went to Mount Logan, as I mentioned earlier, with Fabrizio in 2007. So we'd done that together. And we had each had separately the idea of doing this route on the east side of Huntington. Fabrizio and I had climbed a route on the west face of Huntington, just left of his route, the Phantom Wall. And Fabrizio and I did a route to the left of it that we called the Imperfect Apparition. So we'd both already done routes on Huntington. But the east face of Huntington, in case people don't know, still has some things to do. So initially that was the primary goal of the trip. And I knew about the east face of Huntington because actually the last climb that Chabot did with Alex was on the east face, and they were trying a new route that ended up not going, so they ended up repeating the one major line that's in the middle of the face. So anyway, we go there with that in mind, and we get to the bottom of the face, and it's like not even remotely an ice climb. It's like dry as a bone. It was like big wall climbing instead of ice climbing. So we went, well, shit, what do we do now, you know? So we went over and did the rooster's cone, which Westman told me later was the fifth ascent, but it was, we didn't know anything about it. We just was looking, well, let's just go do that since
that's
we're
classic
here.
Mark.
You know?
Like an encyclopedia.
Right. And then, but it was a consolation at the very best. Yeah. And we went back to the tent anyway, climbed back up in the cirque where Paul had landed us, and started looking around. I was like, well, fuck. You know, like, look at that, and like, look at that. And Jay's got a very good creative eye for routes. Amazing. Maybe his best a skill of that as anyone I've ever known, actually. So, anyway, we did this route on the South Peak of Huntington, and we did these ice climbs, which are just fun, you know, cool day climbs from the tent. You know, it's like right over there. And then all of a sudden, you know, we actually sort of saved the trip at that point because we'd actually done something that was interesting and fun versus what we thought the first day we got underneath the east face, and it was not happening. So, you know, we get Paul to come pick us up and fly out, and he needed to go get somebody to kill in the base, so we land there. And so we're flying out, and I asked Paul if he'd, you know, take a slight detour on the way to Talkeetna. Because there was this face opposite the South Peak of Hunter that Doug and I had climbed that we called the Sound of Freedom. It looks right at the North Face of Thunder. And I'd, you know, it'd been on the list, you know, for a long time, you know, 10 years. And we fly by it, and it's like in the best shape I've ever seen it. Even before we landed in Talkeetna, we decided we'd come back in. And all we needed to do was, you know, I had to call Pat and he had to call Kitty to say we might be a few more days, you know. Other than that, it was a done deal. So we went back in as soon as we got some new ropes and did this thing. And it was, you know, it was a really good effort. You know, Jay led the cruxes. And it's an amazingly beautiful line. It's got some objective danger, but not a ton if you move quickly at the and you know things are cold enough and all that lines up. So we did this thing, and we did it fairly fast for two old guys. And I think it took us like 67 hours, tent to tent, and you know, we ran out of food and we ran out of fuel and had a really terrible descent because of snow conditions. But it was great. So, you know, I think our collective combined ages were 111. So, you know, we did okay for not being 20.
Yeah.
So
I wanted to remember to tell you this, but this was probably 1997 or 98, somewhere around there. You came to Alaska and you gave a talk at the Mountaineering Club meeting, and I was there. And you had mentioned in our interview today, you talked about the important philosophy on alpine climbing and partnership is vision, commitment, and trust. And that really resonated with me. I never forgot that. And I actually applied it to my climbing. But I wanted to ask you to talk about that because it made so much sense to me when you said it in so many different ways. So I don't know, maybe talk about where you came up with that and just talk about that as a philosophy a little bit more.
I think I came up with this, you know, these three things just in the process of, you know, having gone through some of these challenging events with some of my partners, and then things ended up being okay, you know, like Kenny breaking his femur on ISIS and you know, Jim and I, you know, getting to Kehlton the base finally on the Diamond Arete. But I also think, you know, climbing, you know, is a pretty cerebral thing. So, you know, it made sense to me that you needed to be committed. And there, you know, what did that mean? You know, just taking it in three parts, what did commitment mean? You know, I mean, it means a lot of things. You know, it means commitment to being as good as you can be in terms of your preparation. It means being committed to the idea of whatever the goal is. But also means being committed to your partner and being committed to that shared thing, because you're not there by yourself, you know, unless you're soloing. So it just seemed like an obvious thing to talk about, you know, because a lot of people and a lot of, you know, different types of climbing events, you know, whether it's, you know, sport climbing or anything, you know, if you're not committed psychologically, it's not going to happen. So therefore, it sort of mattered to me as being an important thing to focus on. Vision's easier maybe than coming up with commitment, because, you know, like I mentioned about Jake, you know, he's always had this eye and this vision about looking at new routes. And, you know, I've done okay at that too. But it isn't just the vision of the creative nature of, you know, imagining where the line would go or how you would piece it together and break it down into pitch by pitch. It also just has to do with whether or not you have the intellectual capacity to just look at something and understand that it can be done, you know, or at least ought to be tried, you know. So it's not like, you know, I'm some smart guy that came up with that. It's just so obvious. And trust, you know, is, you know, I talk about it. You might remember I probably said this at the slideshow, but, you know, it's both a trust in yourself and your partner. You know, trust that is this part of the bond that, you know, Simon talks about in his book. So it's a multifaceted component of the psyche also. You know, there's all these different layers of trust, you know, trusting that you can figure it out and that you can implicitly trust your partner in case something goes south, like what happened to Charlie and I on Augusta. What mainly happened to me and then correspondingly happened to Charlie. So I don't know, it just seemed like a good sort of triad of things to keep in mind, you know, to use as a philosophy about how to look at things. And then, of course, it turns out it applies to everything.
Sun coming up over Arizona sand, fifth gear racing across this land. See your face on the back of your hand, looks like the sky's gonna fall. Remember the times you were were a kid, no one raised hell quite like you did. Live by the cold, die by the patch, the stars all shine for you. Oh, stormy, right to the daylight. Oh, stormy, right to your home.
As my conversation with Jack came to a close, I was grateful that I'd got to spend an afternoon with one of the great alpinists of our time. Jack's one of those people that when you listen to his stories, you think to yourself, they just don't make them like that anymore. Before we ended our conversation, I asked Jack to reflect on what's important to him today and where he sees the future of alpinism heading.
Speaking when you got something to say, but they always twist your words. Oh, stormy, right to the daylight.
I think, you know, I've touched on it a little bit, you know, the relationships with other people are what's most important. You know, my wife, Pat, who's right behind us here in the yurt, is the most important thing in my life and our relationship. And my friends. And, you know, I'm fortunate, you know, to be able to enjoy being retired, and we travel a lot and get to go do cool things and go climbing and see places we haven't seen before. And so, I mean, all that is really important to me, to be able to have that, you know, shared interest in different things and be able to share it with other people. So, you know, I still like going climbing, and I still, you know, hope springs eternal, right? So I still think that there's, you know, a chance that I could, even though I just broke my back, I can, you know, still, I'm still not dead yet, you know, so there's a few other things I'd still like to do as far as, you know, real roots in the mountains, you know. So that's, I would be lying to say that's not important to me, but it's not as important as it used to be. You know, your situation, you were talking about your injury and that changed everything. You know, I didn't say this before, but I've struggled with it, and so have many other people. But, you know, this is all about how you define yourself. You know, it's all about self-image, you know. And, you know, if somebody asked me, you know, most of my adult life, you know, how I define myself, it wasn't as a sales rep, you know. That was just a way to make money. You know, I enjoyed the business part of it. But, you know, the answer was the climber, you know, not what I did for work. So, you know, to have setbacks or injuries or things happen where you can't do what you love, you know, is a really valid, challenging thing, because it fucks with your self-image, you know. So how do you end up redefining yourself, like you talked about, is, you know, can be an important but also challenging thing. So as I've gotten older, I just, you know, I've accepted that I'm probably not going to ever climb 14A, you know, it's just not going to happen for me, because it turns out I never climbed anything harder than 12A when I was young, so, you know, that's not going to happen. And there's other things that are more serious that I've, you know, come to understand and accept, but it doesn't mean you have to give up.
You know, you have such a unique perspective because you've been doing this for so long. What do you think about where climbing is at today? And have you seen it change, and where do you think it's headed?
That's
It's a good question.
And
the point. Yeah, no, I think it's a good question, and I've thought about this, you know, actually for a long time. I think where the sport is and where it's headed are really essentially the same as they've always been, which is it's an ongoing creative evolution of the sport or the endeavor, you know, of the people involved now that are at the height of the alpine game, let's say, or any part of climbing, you know, are setting standards and doing things in ways that I think are fantastic. And there's very little that I can, you know, criticize, except for, you know, things. I'm not as, you know, hardcore about ethics as maybe some people, but I think, you know, I think gluing and chipping is bullshit. That's wrong. I think putting bolts next to a perfect crack, that's not good either. Okay? That's bullshit. But short of those things, you know, one of the reasons I got into climbing and loved it was because it, you know, at least back then, it was anarchy because there were no rules. It was a self-determined environment and quest, you know? You know, I came from organized athletics, so I had these guys running around and, you know, black and white striped shirts with whistles telling me what to do, you know. Never did real well with authority. And so climbing became this venue of opportunity to do what I wanted to do. Clearly that's, you know, not the same today because people, there's so many more people climbing. You need to be stewards of the environment. You need to understand the impacts you're making and make ethical decisions with respect to good practices, taking care of the environment. But as far as what people are doing, I think it's fantastic for the most part. You know, I can't think of too many things. I mean, and so where is it going? It's going to continue to go. I mean, 20 years ago, people that, you know, actually weren't very thoughtful would never have said, you know, that Adam Andra can do 15C. Right? And it's just going to keep going that way. There's no glass ceiling, in my opinion. Whether it's alpine climbing or any other part of the sport, because people are just that much better. They're that much more focused. They're that much more willing to train. They're that much smarter about diet and all these things that just keep feeding it, I think. And, you know, I know some of the best young alpinists in the world, and, you know, they look at things differently than we did, which is good. You know, it's an evolution of what's possible. You know, they don't have to be hamstrung by conventional wisdom about, well, this is the way we used to do it. You know, I hate that shit. You know, it's just like, you know, back in the day, whatever. You know, it's like, it's all about looking forward. It's not about looking back. I mean, in the sense of being hamstrung by things. You know, history's very important. That's not what I meant. Yeah. But understanding of what's possible is a direct result, I think, to a large degree, of understanding what's already happened, what's been done, and how it got done, and why it got done. So, you know, like in June when Alex Honnold did Freerider, you know, I mean, quote, you know, how do you top that? Well, either he or somebody else will, because that's just, I think, what happens in the sport, you know. It's like, you know, the 3-minute mile, you know. Someday, you know, maybe that'll happen. You know, and so I think that's what's great about it, because there's this sort of limitless lack of boundaries. You know, that it's all up to the individual to put everything together and work hard, train, and have some vision and commitment. You know.
Way to bring it back around. Yeah.
I am a traveler at the speed of light. I don't know where I'll be sleeping tonight. But if you see me, won't you please shine your light? I'm just a boy.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you enjoyed Jack's stories as much as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Don't forget to review the podcast on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, and please consider supporting the show on Patreon or by making a donation at thefernline.com. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line.
Too many losers I gotta get past. Too many addicts living too fast and going nowhere. She was a poet and a writer of songs. Stuck in the middle of a world gone wrong. Never going where she could belong, but where she was chosen. I wish that we could go back in time. We were young and we were feeling alright. I could hold you and you'd still be mine for a while. Too many fools and not enough gold. Too many people that do what they're told. Too many faces never get to grow old. And I wonder, I wish that we could go back in time. We were young and we were feeling alright. I could hold her and she'd still be mine for a while. But the days turn to rain, and I just smile and refrain. She just called me insane, but I just wasn't listening. She said, "You're just not listening. You're not even listening."